Hello and welcome to yet another edition of Britainology, the podcast about Britain and why it's like that, what's going on and how it got this way. I am Milo Edwards, someone who's lived in Britain my entire life, and I'm joined as ever by my intrepid co-host, Nate Bethay.
Hello. Yeah, I'll spare you the dad chat, but I'm learning all about British housing construction, British housing maintenance, British sewer systems, sewer pipes collapsing underneath British houses. Is that a personal story about my actual experience? We'll find out, but I did have a call with Thames Water's engineers this morning for the house that I definitely do not own. And I think I'm going to learn a lot about British infrastructure very shortly. So it feels like the perfect time to talk about some of the,
our culture.
Yeah, some of the ways in which this has imposed itself on other places that might not have turned out this way were it not for a certain kind of British guy. And as a result, we are speaking with James Griffiths, and we're going to talk about Wales. So James is the author of Speak Not, Empire Identity and the Politics of Language from Bloomsbury Press. You're a correspondent from, The Globe and Mail, but in Hong Kong, correct?
Yeah, confusingly, I'm from Ernestmore in North Wales. I live in Hong Kong and work for a Canadian newspaper, just to really confuse everyone.
That could be a trash feature, either co-host bit, quite frankly.
Yeah, really covering the Commonwealth as much as possible.
And so you reached out to us and pitched the idea of talking about Wales, and it was something that Milo and I had talked about previously, and it was really fortuitous because we wanted someone who could speak on the topic about it, because if we just kind of riffed on it, we'd probably get something wrong. And from reading your book, you have both, you know, done a significant amount of research, but also have a personal history as regards the Welsh language. And I guess I wanted to talk to start out with, like, you made the decision to write a book about, to my reading, minority languages and also languages sort of being kind of subsumed into different national languages. You give the example of Welsh and English. You also give the example of Cantonese and Mandarin Chinese. And I guess I have a weirdly personal experience with this to some degree, just because I lived with a host family years and years ago in Brittany, and their grandparents were Breton speakers, but none of the kids spoke Breton. They could understand it, but they didn't speak it. And it's just interesting. So I know a little bit about the way the French government did that to Breton. And so I guess I wanted to ask you, like, as regards Wales's history in the UK, or with, you know, its relationship with England, its relationship with the UK and the Welsh language, like, what do you think is a good starting point that people should know about?
People should know about and probably don't. I mean, this part of British history isn't taught very well, even in Wales, but, you know, Wales and Welsh, the language is basically what everyone spoke in the UK before the Anglo-Saxons arrived and kind of before English took over. And obviously there were Normans and Danes and other people that involved in that. But if you want to really simplify it, Welsh was spoken in the UK, or an ancestor of Welsh was spoken. Britain comes from a Brythonic Welsh word, Prydain. And so Wales is the kind of, you could almost describe it as the surviving part of Celtic Britain, as well, along with Cornwall, that when the Anglos and Saxons and Normans all pushed in from the east, was independent kingdom for many, many centuries, was finally annexed by the English crown in the 1500s, kind of became a principality, was then pretty brutally suppressed as a principality, that, you know, we have all these lovely castles, which are actually symbols of, you know, the Welsh being put down. I grew up opposite Carnarvon Castle, which is one of the largest, and where the armies of Edward Longshanks, the one in Braveheart, where his armies put the Welsh down. And then
Edward Longshanks, the Roadman King.
Yes. And then Wales, the principality, and then kind of over that time remained a largely Welsh-speaking place. But then with the Industrial Revolution, a lot of English workers and Irish workers start coming into Wales to work in the mines, work in the factories, and the Welsh language really starts to come under threat. Then gradually, I mean, we can kind of talk more about the modern history, but, you know, that's a very potted 1,000-year history. It was what they spoke. Yeah. It was Britain. Anglo-Saxons invaded. Eventually, it was annexed. Then it became a principality. Now it's a more semi-independent country within the UK.
It's interesting because one of the figures that you cite in your book is that at the beginning of the 19th century, it was effectively 100% of people in Wales spoke Welsh. And by the middle of the 19th century, because of the influx of English laborers and English industry, it was like 50%. And it's been in decline since. And as I understand it from just being curious on the topic and hilariously being a super furry animals fan, there are areas of Wales where as I understand it, it's like between 0 and 10% of people speak Welsh. But there are some areas of the country where like much larger percentages of people do. But it's still definitely a minority language. I mean, Griff Rhys had said that, you know, Welsh is his first language, but also it's spoken by so few people that it's not even enough to count as like a UN minority language or like a language seeking protection.
No, I mean, I think that's a view from when he was a child, which is from the 80s and the 70s and 80s when it was rapidly in decline. It's been it's been growing since since the like 2010s, 2000s. So since a bunch of reforms that were taken in the 80s and 90s, kind of the generation when I was in school. And then it is now growing and we're headed back for 1 million speakers. I think it's going to be like the first time there's been 1 million speakers since like, I'd have to check the date, but something like, you know, 1903 or something.
Wow.
So it's...
Right, okay. Yeah, because I get, as an English person, I get the impression of Welsh, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that there's a lot of places in North Wales where it's kind of spoken as the primary language, certainly, especially in rural places. And then if you're from South Wales or like urban Wales, you're likely to have learned it in school, but probably not speak it at home. That seems to be the impression I get, but I don't know.
Yeah, so I'm from Ynysmon, Anglesey in North Wales, and I did all of my schooling in Welsh and lived in a largely Welsh/bilingual community. And that's still very much the case for North Wales. You know, kind of Bangor, which is the local city, which has a university, is a lot more English, but basically all the rural areas are predominantly Welsh speaking. And that's true for kind of a lot of mid Wales as well. And then the further south you get, especially in the big cities, the less Welsh is typically spoken, but that is also shifting a lot because of that success of Welsh education. And even in Cardiff, there's a lot more kind of native Welsh speakers there.
Yeah, one of the quotes you have in the book, you say in the very beginning, you say, a child growing up in bilingual Wales today has a far greater connection to their country's past and its native culture than their parents did 40 years ago, even as technology has meant Wales, like all nations, is increasingly globalized and affected by outside influences. Wales has also shown the embrace of an endangered language need not be backward-looking and xenophobic, but can embrace and integrate newcomers, as is currently done with Syrian refugees, many of whose children learn Welsh before they learn English. The revival of Welsh shows that language decline is not inevitable and can be reversed.
Yeah,
and
yeah, I was going to say, so that Syrian reference is because my mum works with refugees, helping resettle them in Wales, and a lot of the kids do Welsh immersion schools and start speaking Welsh while their English is still really rusty, and so sometimes speak better Welsh than English, and better Welsh than some English immigrants as well.
However, it's interesting, it's because a significant chunk of your coverage of Wales in your book is about the fact that this was not always the case. And in fact, there's a significant amount of what you might describe as records of people, Welsh or otherwise, but all sort of like Tory in mindset, in my opinion, basically equating the Welsh language with squalor and poverty and indolence. And the quotes, it feels like one after another, as you cite these quotes, they get more and more almost like eliminationist. Not surprised that probably the worst one comes from the Times, of course, in 1867. But you have some real kind of visceral details here, talking about children being forced to wear a piece of wood around their neck called the Welsh knot, basically that if you are caught speaking Welsh, you were punished. It sounded like, as I understand it, you were flogged for this. You were beaten, but then also you had to wear the sort of shame stick that says like, "Oh, I spoke Welsh today."
Well, it is British schooling.
Yeah. Sneaking into Wales and speaking Welsh and being like, "Oh no, I hope you haven't heard from my uncle."
It's just interesting because it's not the exact same thing, but it's something that I just have a little bit of familiarity with because of having lived in Korea before. But that sounds like what the Japanese did in Korea with children, if they got caught speaking Korean in school, being punished. In some cases, the military dictator of South Korea, like his life was inexorably changed because he was supposed to take, I believe, either military academy exam or civil service exam, but got caught speaking Korean on the day of the exam and was just fully disqualified for it. And it's like, I don't think people would, I'm not trying to say like, oh, it's venal because it's similar. It's more like that feels like it's a colonial impulse. And in the your book, you've done a lot of historical,
I mean, the Romans did it.
Digging. Well, yeah, I mean, that was the thing that we were talking about too. The Romans, that apparently the Romans tried it, and only Welsh elites spoke Latin. Everybody else still spoke Welsh. That's one of the things that I'd read. So I'm interested, like, digging through this, did it make stuff that you had experienced growing up or that you'd heard of from your parents' experience make more sense, that this has just been the impulse for so long?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to see kind of just how both colonial, but also how tied to kind of capitalism and the Industrial Revolution it is, that, you know, Wales was a colony from the 1500s, but there wasn't really much concern with the fact that, you know, a lot of these people spoke a different language to across the border, because all the elites spoke, well, presumably French for most of that period, and then spoke English. And it isn't really until the Industrial Revolution that there's suddenly this concern that everyone in Wales speaks a different language, and you see this big push for people to stop speaking Welsh. And that's both in the name of improving and aiding industry, that there's this idea that there's a bunch of worker unrest in the, what is it, the 1700s, 1800s. And the problem is, they feel, is the Welsh language, rather than, you know, the god-awful conditions in all of these factories and the abuse that the workers are undergoing. They're like, oh, well, people wouldn't complain so much if only they spoke English and they were more civilized. And then the same thing comes in with education, where these absolutely, you know, undeniably terrible conditions in Welsh schools, which according to most researchers were probably the same in most English schools as well, especially rural areas. And they go in and they inspect them, and they say, you know, that kids are, you know, essentially in a hovel with an open fire and, you know, inhaling smoke the entire time during their lessons, and like getting drowsy half the time. And they go to that, and then they say, these are awful. It must be because they all speak Welsh, rather than like recognizing, well, maybe we should fund education and we should, you know, improve conditions. The language is the thing to blame every time. And then, and that, you know, is I think, you know, because they want to have, essentially, they want to have workers that can be moved around the UK that all speak English and that can easily be replaced. And if you have a large Welsh-speaking community, that's a lot harder.
Yeah, that was something I found fascinating from that. You see all these people kind of making kind of, they're getting halfway there with their analysis of being like, seems like this school kind of sucks. And then sort of making a point like, oh, well, it would be beneficial if these children were educated to speak English. Like, sure, fine. But that doesn't mean you have to beat Welsh out of them. It's not really, those two things are not necessarily in opposition with one another.
Yeah, I mean, this is the quote from the Times that you cite from 1867. Now, it seems like most of the stuff that you were describing around the time of the Rebecca riots is the late 1830s, early 1840s, I believe. But so this is much later. But the quote was, speaking of the Welsh language, its prevalence and the ignorance of English have excluded and even now exclude the Welsh people from the civilization of their English neighbors. Annie Steadfod is one of the most mischievous and selfish pieces of sentimentalism which could possibly be perpetrated. It is simply a foolish interference with the natural progress of civilization and prosperity. If it is desirable that the Welsh should talk English, it is monstrous folly to encourage them in a loving fondness for their old language. Not only the energy and power, but the intelligence and music of Europe have come mainly from Teutonic sources, and this glorification of everything Celtic, if it were not pedantry, would be sheer ignorance. The sooner all Welsh specialties disappear from the face of the earth, the better. The times never changed, and it never did.
It never did. I mean, I'm sure, I think I quote later on, I mean, you can find columns like that until well into the 20th and 21st century, you know, maybe not quite so exterminationist in their language, but certainly with that same kind of disdain and the idea that this was a backwards thing. And it's especially funny because I don't know if you guys have ever heard of what an Eisteddfod is, but it's just this kind of campy, you know, slightly hippy-dippy festival where people do poems and recitals. And the idea that it's this pernicious, you know, threat to the state.
Exactly. We've determined that this people dancing around the maypole is actually communism. And yeah, somehow it's a threat to, yeah, the integrity of...
Some of these poems don't rhyme. It's, you know, it's subversive.
And so this brings to another interesting point as you know, going through this, is a lot of the opposition to this from Welsh people. And you cite a bunch of examples, and starting with the sort of opening, talking about the Rebecca riots, which I didn't know about, I'll admit I'd never heard about, and then looked up and I was like, this just seems like something we should talk about on this show. But that in response to taxation because during a time of incredibly poor harvests and just poverty in general in Wales, there was a protest movement that involved attacking toll gates while dressed men would dress up as women and attack them, calling themselves the Daughters of Rebecca.
It is ironic that something which is in its politics fundamentally Welsh nationalist should engage in such a British activity as cross-dressing while destroying road taxing infrastructure.
I know, I was going to say, it was proof that integration had already worked. You know, it's the most English thing they possibly could have done.
You could imagine five guys from Kent now, you know, in maid costumes, smashing up a speed camera with a cricket bat.
Well, you talk about, I mean, so an interesting, I would be interested in learning a little bit more about the context of this, is that you explain the degree to which the poor laws and the creation of the workhouse had made life for average people in all of the UK, all of, you know, the areas controlled by the British government, even more miserable than it had been, as you put it, even during the reign of the Tudors. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that and how that affected Wales specifically?
Yeah, and I think it is, like you said, it is the case throughout the UK and you know, especially in rural areas. You know, Wales was, even though it was industrializing, especially in the south with the mines and the factories, it was still a largely rural area. And so this kind of, the change in how poor relief was done and the kind of shift to these centralized workhouses where people were, you know, essentially imprisoned for being poor, you know, that had a devastating effect. And most of them were, you know, no better than the schools, which they would then complain about kind of 50 odd century later, because, you know, these were terribly built places with hardly any resources, because they, you know, it is that, you know, almost Scroogean idea or Dickensian idea of how you should treat poor people, which is, you know, survival of the fittest, let them die. And, you know, especially if they're backwards country people who speak a different language.
And how far we have come.
Exactly.
And so this then led, this protest movement then led to increased British troop presence in Wales. So sort of, I don't know if
people are cross-dressing, quick, send in the British army. They'll put a stop to that.
So effectively, I don't know if it would be hyperbolic to describe that as that they were then under military occupation, but basically this was a sort of central government force was then keeping security in Wales while the Industrial Revolution was taking place, while as I understand it, South Wales in particular became the site of incredible amounts of extractive industry and manufacturing and things like, but primarily extractive industry.
Yeah, I mean, a massive hub of the Industrial Revolution, but also kind of one of the reasons for this reaction from the British state is that South Wales in particular was a massive hub for worker organizing and the kind of the genesis of the union movement. You know, it is no coincidence that a lot of this oppression, which is tied to the Welsh language, but is also tied to kind of worker resistance in Wales and organizing, and, you know, the sense that people were able to organize and not be spied upon because they were speaking another language was definitely part of it. Mm-hmm.
And then it's interesting because I'll jump a little bit forward, but when you talk about a couple other incidents, one of them was when the decision was made, I don't know what the right verb to use is, but to perform the investiture, to invest Prince Charles, now King Charles, as the Prince of Wales. This led to significant opposition from Welsh nationalists, to include the bombing of the Temple of Peace in Cardiff. And the reason I bring this up, we have some stuff in the early part of the 20th century to talk about as well, but the reason why I bring this up is from your book is because, as you put, like, the British state's reaction was to basically use, I believe, MI5, but to use state security to surveil Plaid Cymru and the, what is it, the Welsh Language Association.
Yeah. Society, yeah. Yeah, I mean, part of that is because of the success. So the bombings in the 60s were done by this group called Mudiadid Amddiffyn Cymru, which is the Movement for Protection of Wales. And they were very successful in kind of being secretive and staying under the radar for quite a long time, and carried out a number of very high-profile bombings, which are largely forgotten. I mean, we kind of forget in Wales, you know, Wales is kind of almost seen as the well-behaving nation compared to Scotland and Northern Ireland. But there was, you know, a terrorist movement in the 1960s, and there were bombings well up into the 80s and burning of holiday homes and things like that. But yeah, the response was basically to suppress the peaceful pro-independence and pro-Welsh language movements and surveil and suppress them, which again, you know, we can see echoes of that elsewhere in the United Kingdom. But the thing with Charles's investiture, I mean, it's notable, you know, not to jump ahead too much in time, but it's notable that there are no plans for William to have such an investiture in Wales. He's just become the Prince of Wales. They're not going to do a big ceremony because the potential because, you know, the investiture was supposed to bring everyone together and make them all happy about the crown, and it didn't really do that.
And bring it back to the thing I want to talk about previously was that it seemed like there would be inciting incidents of the British government either unilaterally or through parliamentary lawmaking, but without any buy-in, any support from Welsh people or Welsh MPs, do things that would just greatly offend people. The two examples that you cited were, I've tried to get the correct Welsh pronunciation, but I believe it's in the, what is it, in Hien, the building the bomber school, bombing ground and bomber school.
Hien Peninsula, yeah. This is a good...
I'm trying, man. I'm really trying. In 1936, or in the 30s, this decision was made. I think you said the decision was made in 1935. They began construction then. And in September 1936, three men burned down the bomber school. And it took a while before they were able to be convicted because juries wouldn't come to an agreement in convicting them. They made a point of arguing with the judge about like their right to speak Welsh in court and things like this.
Yeah, so they wouldn't be convicted in Wales. They burned down a bombing school which the British state proposed to build between the wars, and so this is at a period when kind of there is this idea that the Second World War wasn't necessarily on the horizon in 1935 as much as it would become. And so this was more about controlling the colonies. They talked about the need to bomb, restive colonials out in Iraq and other places. So this is a brutally colonial institution that they wanted to build in one of the most beautiful and untouched parts of Wales and blow up bits of it, and also the most Welsh-speaking parts of Wales. Three people... including Saunders Lewis, one of the founders of Plaid Cymru, they burned this school and then admitted to it, handed themselves in with the idea to go to trial, refused to speak English in the trial. Welsh jury didn't convict them. And so they moved it to London, where they also again refused to speak English and then were promptly convicted.
It's interesting because this was one, and then the second incident, the one that seemed as though it was it propelled another kind of wave of political extremism, or rather just say like confrontations, violent confrontations with the British state, bombings, attacks on property, attacks on government sort of symbols, was the similar decision-making process for the government, the British government building a dam and thereby a reservoir in the valley of Treweren that then flooded this entire valley. And once again, it was a thing that was done. There was opposition, but it was
where people lived as well. Had to, turf out a bunch of people and then drowned a village, for none of which of the water went to Wales. It all was piped across the border to Liverpool, was the most kind of, and Treweren remains, there's a big sign near where I grew up called Cofio Treweren, Remember Treweren. There's been very famous graffiti that's been there, for decades. And it remains a real, symbol, because you couldn't ask for one that's better. They literally wanted to drown a Welsh village to give water to people in England. No Welsh lawmakers were consulted on this, and none of them had any input, and there were protests, and it was all ignored. And yeah.
Only the British government could look at Wales and be like, what if it was weather? Too dry, in my opinion, Wales.
And so this touches off a really interesting period, because, when you think about the political landscape in the 1930s versus the mid-1960s, it's so very different. And this leads to the emergence of, once again, trying as hard as I can, maybe on Glyndwr and other groups, as you've cited in the book, basically carrying out a guerrilla movement in Wales. Like, that's maybe exaggerating it, but
yeah, I mean,
attacking,
that was their aspiration, certainly. Mudiadad and Irvine Cymru, Meibion Glyndwr is I know the names sound really similar, but Meibion Glyndwr is the 70s and 80s burning holiday houses.
Excuse me.
But Mudiadad and Irvine Cymru, which were a kind of effective and very secretive militant movement, which carried out a number of very high-profile bombings. And then also simultaneously this thing called the Free Wales Army, which were basically just a tabloid newspaper existence. So this you know, slightly nutty horse trader who used to go to the tabloids and say, oh yeah, I'm building the Welsh version of the IRA. Come and watch me do, like, movements, training movements in the countryside dressed in military gear, but didn't actually do anything.
The Welsh IRA is 100% a trash YouTube bit. I'm pleased to hear there was one guy crazy in it.
Yeah, we've inaugurated it here. And
he used to go over to Belfast and, like, take part in IRA things and get himself in photographs and things. So
I bet they love that.
It's probably even more popular than the Americans.
Yeah. It was like when you take the mascot out on the pitch at the start of the football game, you know? They were like, look at this guy, the one-man Welsh IRA.
So this must...
You can hold the paving slab over the SAS guy's head. Go on.
I've also heard someone talk about a group called the Cameroon Rouge in the 70s, that there were these organizations
That's not branding you'd go for,
I know,
is it?
I know, but that this is the... I don't know if that's apocryphal, but I have heard people talk about... I've just seen people talk about it online. And I'm reminded of things like Edda in...
The Welsh nationalist movement, who kills everyone who can speak Welsh because it means they've been to school.
I've seen there's a Breton separatist movement in Brittany. There's the Edda in the Basque Country, obviously. And this, I feel like you said earlier at the beginning of this recording that, you know, this history isn't taught very well in anywhere in Britain, to include Wales. I feel as though there is more of an awareness. Certainly, there's more of an awareness of Edda. There is, at least in Brittany and in France, an awareness of this. It's died off mostly, but of this kind of movement there. I wanted to ask you, because I didn't grow up in this country, do you feel as though this history of this kind of pre-devolution confrontation with the state is known about, that people are aware of it?
I don't think really at all. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm too young to have lived through it, but like I was born in 88, so kind of towards the end of the Holiday Homes campaign, and that was, there remained a lot of awareness. And I don't know what Milo's experience was, but I think that was an awareness through the UK, that people knew that they were burning holiday homes. Or,
yeah, I mean, I would have been before. I was born in 93, so I think I haven't heard of that, but maybe at the time.
Could you go into more detail on that? Because I mean, you touch on it in the book, but like, I'm sure that in researching it, you've encountered some anecdotes and stuff. I'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah, so in a very Welsh connection, my sister's ex-husband's mum's cousin is one of the only people who was ever jailed over the Holiday Homes burnings. But this is a campaign, but no one else was jailed. Like I think it was literally one guy who was dumb enough to brag about it in a club and may not have actually been involved. Kind of,
so they didn't jail the guy who started the Welsh IRA, but they jailed your distant relative.
They jailed this guy who's a teenager at the time and yeah, was just bragging about it in a club. But no, the actual people behind the campaign were never caught. I think possibly it remains an open case, even though it's decades old at this point. But this was this period, yeah, during the 70s and 80s, when you were seeing a lot of English families starting to buy holiday homes in North Wales in particular, and especially on the Llyn Peninsula. Which is the most Welsh-speaking part of Wales, and there was a sense that there was anger both over what this did to local house prices, but also that these were English immigrants coming in, largely pushing out Welsh families to leave houses empty half the time. And so a campaign began of torching them. And, you know, not with anyone inside, it's worth saying. This is not a, you know, no one was ever injured in this thing, but they did burn, I think...
Well, the Welsh IRA weren't involved.
The Welsh IRA weren't involved. But I think it's around 200 houses were torched before the end of the campaign. And it's happening. The British government would never admit that this was a factor, I think. But it is a lot of this stuff, both the bombings in the 60s and 70s and the arsons in the 80s, are happening as the British government is taking kind of policies designed to, you know, to win support in Wales in support of the Welsh language and things like that. And I think you know these should be connected, that there was a sense in London that, you know, if they didn't do something to kind of ameliorate Welsh people, that these things could get worse and it could become, you know, not, it's exaggeration to say it could become another Northern Ireland, but at least head in that direction.
Well, they were dealing with the nice people of the holiday home tortures, so they didn't have to deal with the one guy from the Welsh IRA.
before I move on to that that period of history, I do want to ask, just because you have this expertise, have you heard of the Khmer Rouge? Is that a real thing, or is that just something apocryphal?
No, it certainly didn't come up in my research. I mean, it may have also been similar to the Free Wales Army, that they were just a complete, you know, they were an invention of the, or not even an invention of the media, invention of some nutbag who then went to talk to the media all the time.
Right. I mean, it is very, very funny just to envision the sort of like the way that you see when these things take place, like all of the splinter groups and their absurd names, but just getting more and more, I don't know, like, what's the right word here? Like more and more rooted in wealth mythology, to the point where like people in England aren't even going to be scared by it. Like, I just don't even know what that is. I have no idea how to say that.
Paul Potts and the Khmer Rouge.
So then we get to sort of the first steps towards the present day situation, in which the British government has allowed for bilingual education and has sort of relaxed the centralized control to some degree. You have political devolution in the constituent nations in the UK. And I don't know how that manifests in Wales, but like you said earlier, you corrected me earlier when I quoted the thing from Griff Rhys about the Welsh language, that it's no longer in dire decline. So things start to change. And we find ourselves in a situation now where the Welsh language is no longer in extreme decline. Could you talk us through how that began? Because I had always thought that was a late Major and Blair thing, but it sounds like, as you described it, that it actually, some of it started earlier. And I would never in a million years have imagined Thatcher going along with something like that. But
it is largely Thatcher. I mean, there's this bizarre situation where Thatcher, while simultaneously, you know, immiserating Wales through her labor and mining policies, is actually a relatively good on language policy. And some of that is, you know, just because there was a slow kind of building momentum towards this, then probably any government in Westminster would have had to do it. But also because there was this sense that this was maybe an issue that they could break away some voters on. There's this great quote from Thatcher where she once complained, from Cabinet Office notes, where she once complained that the only Conservatives in Wales are the English who moved in. And so there was this sense that she could win Welsh votes through Welsh language policy, which, you know, who knows, they might have done if she didn't become an absolute hate figure, deservedly so, for what she did to Welsh mining.
Right. And so that leads us to reforms that then allow for the creation of bilingual education and a movement to, or basically allowing that to be in place in primary education in Wales.
Primary education, well, through to 14, and then it's expanded. Yeah, it's expanded progressively after that.
So you grew up with bilingual, you said you were born in 88 and you grew up with bilingual education. So, I mean, could you maybe talk through what that was like? And I was particularly interested in your anecdote about your father relearning Welsh, learning to speak it, in the sense that like there's now more of an opportunity to.
Yeah, and this is the biggest thing that changed it. You know, that whenever I talk to people about other minority languages, unfortunately, the big like lesson from Welsh is you need educational policy support to promote the language, because this is the major thing that's changed it. You know, everything else has helped massively, but the big thing that's revived the Welsh language is the 88 reforms that make it a compulsory subject. And so that when I was in primary school, all of my lessons except for English were in Welsh. And then when I went to secondary school, most of my lessons were, and then they kind of gradually shifted because of what doesn't exist anymore, but was a kind of bilingual stream where you could choose. And because I spoke English at home, because both my parents were born in England, even though we're a Welsh family, I kind of gradually drifted towards doing more and more English. But you could have done, you know, right through to A-levels 18 in Welsh the whole way. And now you have that generation are now, or my generation are now having children, or the generation below us have also grown up with this. And it's just had such a huge kind of shift. And with each generation, it's got stronger. And so I spoke to kind of much younger people who kind of described that there isn't really any kind of, that the awareness is so different, that they're just used, it's just normal that everyone speaks Welsh and that everyone learns Welsh and that they can consume culture in Welsh and that you'll do, you know, there's a lot more Welsh music and things like that. And it's just been this profound shift, which bizarrely Wales has Margaret Thatcher to thank for.
Yeah, that is a really strange one, isn't it? And I recall Because I think about the timeline that this is, you know, I was born in 84, so this is over the course of my lifetime, and there's some things that I can think of that were examples of Welsh language in media, and just because I said earlier, being a Super Furry Animals fan, I don't know how to, I think it's Mung, is how you pronounce the name of the album? It's M-W-N-G that was, they put out in 2000 that was all in Welsh. But I just recall reading an interview with Griff Rhys talking about that album in Welsh and saying, like, insisting, like, you will not put a fucking dragon on the cover. I don't want this to be associated with, as, like, seen as a Welsh nationalist thing. It's just, this is the language. This is all, every member of the band, this is our first language. And it seemed that in 2000, that was, which I don't want to acknowledge was 23 years ago, but it was, that was a more novel thing. And it seems like that shift has taken place to where it's not as much anymore.
Yeah, and one of the biggest things kind of in culture recently that really struck me was, ironically, watching the episode of The Crown that's actually about the investiture, because it shows they sent Charles to Aberystwyth to study Welsh because he gave a brief Welsh speech as part of the investiture and learned some of the language. And they showed him both learning from a Welsh professor, but then they also showed this professor's home life, which is completely in Welsh, which is, you know, accurate. But I think if that had been made perhaps even 10 years earlier, it A, would have been played for laughs way more, and B, I don't think they would ever have had the scenes of him at home speaking Welsh. He'd have spoken English, or they just wouldn't have included them. That there is just this kind of acknowledgement, even outside of Wales, that this is a real language that people really still speak and is growing and, you know, still exists. And that kind of dismissiveness, or the kind of general dismissiveness of it within Anglo-British culture, has slightly diminished, even though there is still a lot of hostility towards it from kind of the right-wing press.
I think about some of the ways in which some of the unionist parties in Northern Ireland treat the Irish language, even when they're in something like in political meetings, like more or less just making fun of it, doing like comically bad pronunciations, like to kind of, that's, I don't say that that's one-to-one comparison or totally fucking overlap, but rather that dismissiveness, I think, comes through, and I can just sort of like fill in the blanks and assume that that level of dismissiveness is probably the same or was the same, you know, towards Welsh language and culture. Because, and that brings me to like sort of the last segment of this I wanted to talk about. One thing that I think someone who doesn't know anything about the area might not be aware of is that Wales statistically is poorer than certainly Southeast England. Obviously there's areas of England in the north, particularly in the, I believe in the northeast, but also the northwest, that are incredibly not doing well. But I wanted to talk about like that, the centrality, the kind of British government control, and the way in which people may not realize that like this region has suffered economically because of the fact that it is an sort of extractive satellite, at least in how the British government runs it. Could you talk about that and about like those conditions, and then we'll kind of transition, if we have time, into also like politics today in Wales, because it is very different than England.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Wales was for a long time the industrial heart of the UK, and then became, you know, the site of major post-industrial decline. You know, there's kind of, it's not even really a joke in the book, because it's from a real like Welsh language learning thing that my dad did, that where just the scenario in it, which is just used as an example, is basically a town with nothing, where there's like no taxi service, no bus service, no cinema, there's nothing to do, because you've just seen this complete hollowing out of huge parts of Wales as you know, industry left and jobs left. And some of that was replaced by Europe. There was an Airbus factory, Airbus construction in Wales, and there was some other construction, and now a lot of that is leaving as a result of Brexit, and it's happening again, and it's gonna, you know, immiserate parts of Wales all over again.
And politically, Wales seems like it's very different than England, in the sense that you quoted Thatcher there about, yeah, the only Tories in Wales are English holiday home owners or people who've moved there. I've heard people say that about Scotland, and I know that is not true. There are plenty of homegrown Scottish Tories.
Not even close.
I know,
to true
but
Scotland.
They like to think that. But it seems like in Wales that the Welsh Labour still does quite well, and Welsh Labour as a separate entity is now far to the left of what the national labor, the Labour Party of England, basically, or the national UK Labour Party, is putting forward. And so I know that you aren't necessarily doing local politics stuff while not living in Wales, but I'm wondering, like, what's your take on that? Why is that the case, and how, why do you think that is?
Yeah, you know, the Tories have failed to make real inroads into Wales at all. I think that, you know, there's been a handful of times where they've had maybe 3 or 4 MPs, and then it can drop down to 1 or even 0 at times. I think in, I'd have to check, but I think 2017 or 2019, they lost an MP, they lost even, they had 0 MPs. Anyway, sorry, don't include that because I'd have to check it. But yeah, the Tories have failed to make real inroads for years. There are Welsh Conservatives, of course, you know, wealthy farmers, kind of English immigrants, you know, the usual landlord types, but they are, I don't know, they're outnumbered enough by kind of the sheer quantity of Labour voters, and the first past the post doesn't seem to benefit them in the way that it does in other parts of the country. And so you end up with a consistently Labour government being returned for every single year since devolution in the Welsh Senedd. And then also Wales sends nearly only, or predominantly Labour MPs to Westminster, along with Lib Dems. Lib Dems are basically the Conservatives in Wales, because that's as far right as most people go. And then you have through Plaid Cymru, you have a kind of genuine left alternative, which has also attracted a lot of votes in recent years, you know, both as a pro-independence movement, but also as kind of a movement that's seen as pushing Welsh Labour to the left.
And so do you feel like, looking at the situation in the United Kingdom at present, I wonder if you think that perhaps Wales is going to be in a better position because of that, or is it still going to just be hit by the same trends that is affecting the entire country? It feels like if you live in a local authority in England, for example, in the last 15 years, you have watched everything get worse because everything's been cut, powers have been restricted. I mean, if you go back even further, you know, from before Thatcher until now, it's night and day how much what a local authority does and can do and is funded to do has changed. I have this feeling that a local, you know, even through devolution, that can't change that much. But then I also have friends who have left England and moved to Scotland. And like, even if it's 20% better, it's still 20% better. So I'm interested, do you feel as though that kind of creates also kind of a separate experience of living in this country because you live in Wales and you're governed, you know, the people in charge, notionally in charge at the local level are not, it's not as lockstep with the sort of like full on austerity mindset.
Yeah. I mean, it's Britain, so it's still shit, but it's, you know, not.
I see you listen to this show.
But it's not. Yeah. I think I would agree with your friend that
don't like it. There's the Severn Estuary.
It is a little bit better. Devolution has protected Wales to a certain extent, though Wales is not as devolved, does not have quite as many powers as the Scottish Parliament. And there is a push. Mark Trafford, the Welsh First Minister, has pushed for, you know, greater devolution, but run up against this really strong unionist current, both in the Tories and under Keir Starmer's Labour. So that this, I think, is going to be the big kind of battle that's going to come up, is you've got this real push from London to kind of rein in devolution. But this is really something that, you know, kind of, I think, probably inevitably runs towards independence in both Scotland and Wales, that this is just, you know, as you start to give people more and more control over their region, they're not going to give it up and they only ask for more. There was polling recently by YouGov that showed that a majority of people wanted greater devolution or independence. So it's, you know, there is a real kind of confrontation coming between kind of a unionist London and more Welsh IRA, exactly.
Well, so I guess maybe I should ask the two things I want to ask first, because I've been kind of doing the talking, and I guess Milo, I was going to ask you really quickly, like, you grew up, you, as you say at the beginning of every show, you've lived in this country your whole life. Like, reading this book, where there are certain things about Wales that you were like, oh, I didn't know that, or like, do you feel as though any of this you have considered, like, your experiences there? Because I've never been there, I know you have, but like, what it's portrayed as versus kind of learning this stuff now?
I mean, yeah, I think it's not surprising, really, although I'm probably not the typical English person in terms of like my attitude to these things necessarily, but Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that, like, yeah, the Welsh language is basically an outlier in terms of the fact that it seems to be coming back, whereas most of these languages seem to be kind of, like, inexorably in decline. I mean, like, they're desperately trying to make Scots Gaelic a thing, but, like, no, just fundamentally no one speaks it and no one's going to. Whereas, like, Welsh had that base of people who actually spoke it in their everyday life, and so was able to come back from that, which is, you know, a cool thing to sort of bring that culture back from the brink, I guess. But then also, I think, yeah, like, in terms of the economic factors, like, I think this is a thing that we've talked about a lot on this show, in terms of there, like, all of these are things which happen in England as well. And I think it's easy to see them through the lens of, like, oh, this is happening in Scotland or Wales or whatever, when actually it's kind of like a, it just depends on where you live, basically. Like, if you live in a nice part of Wales, it's nice. If you live in a shit part of Wales, it's shit. If you live in a nice part of England, it's nice. If you live in a shit part of England, it's shit. If you have money, it's good. If you don't have money, it's bad. And I think there's a lot of attempts are made to kind of, like, I guess, subdivide British people into, like, oh, well, like, Northerners are like this, or, like, Welsh people are like this, or whatever it might be. When, in fact, most people are, like, you know, still bound by fundamentally their economic circumstances.
You're still going to go down the street and there's going to be a Greggs and a Costa, regardless of where you are. It's a universal experience.
Yeah. Well, it's like the thing you were saying earlier about the you know, saying that there's, like, no Scottish Tories or whatever. Like, it just fucks me
up. Well, I don't believe
like,
it. I'm just saying I've heard people say that.
No, I know. But as in, it's just like, it's like a kind of, I think, and so that's the only way in which I'm a bit skeptical of the, I guess, the independence movements. And I think that they cover for a lot of, like, quite, like, I don't know, I just find nationalism to always be a bit, whilst I also think that the treatment of, like, the Welsh language and culture is a thing that absolutely has to be reversed, and seems like it's in the process of being reversed, which is great. There's also this sense of, like, I think we also need a greater unity between the various constituent nations of the UK, with the possible exception of Northern Ireland, which probably will go back, in order to combat the larger forces at play, which are as prevalent in England as they are in Scotland or Wales.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from a British political landscape, there is, you know, I'm sure you could probably, you know, tie growing support for independence in Wales to the fact that Wales has consistently elected left-wing governments during the last 20 years, while Britain elected right-wing ones. And, you know, had there been a kind of parallel there, and had you had Labour governments this entire time, you know, especially kind of a left-wing Labour government, there might not be so much energy. And it's probably true in Scotland as well, that there, you know, that some of this nationalism is more about, it's a bit like the motivations for Brexit, right? That everything's shit, so we may as well try something new.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think my concern with it is much like Brexit. It's a, like, everything's shit. Why not potentially make it a lot worse?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you too, like, I would be very happy if those took place in terms of the people in constituent nations deciding to be independent, if that was, like, the decision made. I wouldn't want to live in the English nationalist rump state, I gotta be honest with you. I'm a little freaked out about what that's gonna be like, but
I always think it always reminds me of, you know, you see people in the US, Nate, with who kind of want to write off the South, and everyone's like, yeah, but what about all the, you know, all the left-wing and people of colour that live in the South?
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same in Wales, where people are like, oh, just fuck England, we'll have our own little left-wing country.
It is also very frustrating, too, if you talk about in the American context, because at the end of the day, because we have the federal system, like, it's so incredibly difficult. And also, for better or worse, I mean, my dad's family is all from Mississippi and North Carolina. Like, at the end of the day, in states, most white people in America vote Republican. In state, there's some states where more vote Democrat or more vote for non-Republicans. In the South, it's pretty bad. It's pretty consistent. Like, and there's some states that are better than others. My dad's home state of Mississippi, it's like 95% of white people vote Republican. And so you just, even with voter suppression, you don't have the ability to overcome that. It is just, it is what it is, unfortunately. But because we have a system where states have so much control and so much kind of, like, enclosure, even if a nationally very, very left-wing government, God willing, took power in America, it would still be challenging, because the system is set up to be basically to protect the slavery constitution. And some people might see that as being, you know, reductive, but, like, fundamentally they weren't shy about saying that when they wrote the fucking constitution. So that's my America a little bit there. I see the same point you're making, though, is that, like, you don't want to write those people off, but the issue that you have also is that it's the way that the system is constructed. Like, Wales could vote enormously for a left-wing government. You know, like you said, basically you had situations where every constituency goes either to Plaid Cymru or to Labour, but that's not enough to affect the just Tory vortex that is Southern England. And that is who will, you know, the MPs that they'll send to Parliament, and that's who's going to be making the rules.
And if there is independence eventually, it's all going to have been driven from London, basically. You know, it's all going to be kind of London policy that provokes this. That, you know, this kind of started under Johnson, but this idea to kind of claw back some devolution, some devolved powers, is just insanely unpopular and is going to lead to a kind of a backlash, which probably results in a push for greater powers. And whereas if they did the Labour tactic under Blair, which was kind of to support devolution and support even a move towards what's called Devo Max, you probably have a relatively happy constituency, which has a lot of control over domestic policy, but is happy to remain within the union.
I was going to say, they keep trying to claw stuff back, and the Daughters of Rebecca are getting in drag. They're going to go set fire to the motorways, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Yeah, Rishi Sunak is going to privatize Wales. He's going to put Serco in charge.
And
it's going to be very popular.
It is very funny, though, that what you just described, because I think this is true as well, that in the United States, to some degree, that they could get away with so much if they just didn't push it that far. Like, if they just conceded a certain degree of autonomy, they could probably get away with a lot of really unpopular national policy, really destructive national policy. But it seems the Tories just, I don't know, like, without fully making it this British politics corner, they just don't really... It's like dealing with billionaires. I mean, many of them are. It's like they have this force field of money and whatever else in British politics kind of around them, in my opinion, that distorts reality. They don't realize, like, this shit doesn't play very well. Like, people don't want this. It's just that, like, everyone they talk to in London and at the Spectator Garden Party does, in fact, want this, or wants it out of spite versus out of, like, actual policy, you know, desire.
Yeah.
And so,
well, because now we're in the era of the Tory party where they don't really care about any of the old stuff anymore. They're not really interested in, I think, like, you know, like Britain as a constituent country, or in, like, you know, the tea and cake with the vicar or whatever the fuck. They're only interested in extracting wealth, basically, at this point. So, like, even it, like, it's like the way they're just basically giving Northern Ireland back at this point. Like, they just don't care. Like, it suits them right now to do that. So even though that would have been like Tories from even 10 years ago couldn't have considered that as an option. They're like, yeah, fuck it, it means we can steal more money. Like, it's actually incredible to see Tories being like this. Like, they're fully, like, they've reached nirvana. They've given up on all of, like, the shackles of earth, and they care only about rentierism. It's quite incredible in a way.
James, I'm going to ask this as kind of the final question. I'm interested in your take. As regards Wales, do you actually think independence is likely, or even, like, an independence movement is going to make headway?
I think if the current conditions remain the same, that then there is a lot of room for an independence movement. That some of it has been, there is growing support and growing support in polls and things like that, but some of it's been stifled by the fact that there is a relatively popular Labour government in Cardiff, and that if you have a kind of less popular, more maybe Keir Starmer style government, because Keir Starmer's not very popular in Wales, and Drakeford. Drakeford, while not a particularly charismatic figure, actually is relatively popular, though actually, you know, by a
even when he jams out on the clarinet,
by a modern British politician standards, which means his, like, overall balance of popularity is still, like, below zero, but it's not quite as far below zero as all of the others. I'm just going to say that, yeah, but I think if there is, you know, if that kind of level of detachment, that sense of detachment between popular sentiment within Wales grows from the rest of the UK, that then I think you'll see growing support for independence, and that Labour in particular has managed to, Labour in Wales rather, has managed to siphon off pro-independence voters in a way that Scottish Labour never did. And that some of that is definitely to do with Drakeford and previous leaders. But if you have it's not hard to imagine a similar situation where they really screw it up like Scottish Labour did and suddenly see a huge chunk of voters shift to Plaid Cymru.
I'm just now imagining Keir Starmer reenacting the scene from The Crown that you describe, where he's having to learn Welsh and be taught so he can give a speech and just like somehow managing to fuck it up. I can only imagine Milo Voice doing Welsh for Keir Starmer, but
yeah, unfortunately my knowledge of the Welsh language is far
too
we
could have set up this bit. I could have written a script, everything.
I know, right? Yeah. This could have literally been, like I said, like it just takes so much work. Milo has to do the Welsh training that King Charles did so he can do the bit about Keir Starmer doing it and fucking it up.
There you go. This is what the Patreon
it's like three echelons deep meta commentary on this. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean, that that were they to put a Keir Starmer analog in power in Welsh Labour, you could see the Nationalist Party somehow becoming far more popular. And who knows what that actually leads to, but it certainly, in terms of first past the post, creates a situation where you might have some problems. But James, we're coming up on an hour. I wanted to give you a chance to plug your book. It was published by Bloomsbury, but I wanted you to be able to talk about how people can get it and also like any other work you've got going on now that you want people to read.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. People can buy it wherever you can buy books, including, you know, I always feel bad plugging Amazon, but you can get it on Amazon. It's called Speak Not, Empire Identity and the Politics of Language. It's not only about Welsh, it's also about the movement to revive Hawaiian under kind of American colonialism and control, and then also the decline or the threat to Cantonese here where I live in Hong Kong from kind of growing Chinese control over Hong Kong. Paperback came out this year. I encourage people to buy it. And then if they're interested in, this is maybe a more trash future audience style book, but my first book, The Great Firewall of China, How to Build and Control an Alternative Version of the Internet, that came out in paperback last year. It's a kind of history of Chinese internet censorship and complicity of American companies in that, and then also how that type of internet censorship has spread around the world.
All right. What a broad-based education you could get from these two books.
Exactly.
That really is a double. So it remains for us only to thank James very much.
Thank you, Dilkhan Bauer.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And if you're a listener to this, thank you very much for being a Patreon subscriber. I'm not sure which tier this is going out on. So, hey, if you're listening to it, you know what tier it's on. You know what level of payment you give us every month. So thanks for doing that. And we will be back at you very soon with some more Britannology. We've got one on the British tabloids coming up. Should be a lot of fun. So stay tuned for that.